This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Cape Lookout is a popular attraction for tourists and locals alike. You can climb the lighthouse, see the wild horses, and comb miles of pristine coastline for seashells. For the past 5 years, Pat Kinney has been the superintendent at Cape Lookout. It was announced last week that he will be leaving Eastern North Carolina next year to take a job at Yellowstone National Park. This week, I spoke with Mr. Kinney about his new role and what he treasures most about our coast.
I am a transplant to Eastern North Carolina. I was born in the Midwest and moved all over. This is, I guess, will be my eighth state I'll be in now in my life.
How has the park grown and changed since you've been the superintendent?
I'm proud of the work that the team here at the park has done. We've done a lot of great things, I think, for the public. Looking back, you know, we've really made some great improvements for accessing the park. We've gone through and established a very professional passenger ferry service at the south end, serving Shackelford and the Cape Lookout Lighthouse area. We've done a lot of great improvements up at the Portsmouth Village, the historic village at the north end, to restore some of those historic structures and make them available to the public.
You were also part of doing some restoration to the lighthouse, keeping that up and running.
We've taken on some projects to improve the lighthouse. You know, we got it painted recently, and there's actually more work to be done on that lighthouse, and the public will be seeing some, and that's groundwork that we've laid, and it's an old building. It seems to always need a little bit of love and care, but I think it's such an iconic part of the park. You know, the public comes to Cape Lookout National Seashore usually on their list of things to do are to see the lighthouse, climb the lighthouse, and they want to see the wild horses on Shackelford Banks.
You are going to become the deputy superintendent at Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming. I hear it's getting pretty cold there. Are you ready for that?
Yeah, it's going to be a little bit of a shock to our bodies when we relocate to northern Wyoming. But I grew up in the Midwest, so I'm used to cold winters from my childhood. I'm sure we'll adapt. We're really excited.
What will be your responsibilities at Yellowstone?
As the deputy superintendent, my main job will be to manage the operations of the park. You know, the day-to-day operations of the park really fall on the deputy superintendent. The superintendent tends to work on the bigger issues facing the park. Currently, they're working on things like the delisting of grizzly bears, the management of bison, some of those bigger issues, whereas the deputy will tend to focus on the internal operations, so to speak. I'm the guy that'll keep the trains running on time.
So when do you start that job?
I'll be relocating in January. The exact date's not quite firmed up yet.
Who will fill the superintendent spot at Cape Lookout National Seashore? Is there somebody already in line for that position, or do you have some sort of selection process you go through?
Right. I'm sure that people are interested in knowing how that goes about, but the job will be advertised. The regional director based in Atlanta, Georgia, will be making the selection. There'll be a recruitment process. Somebody will be selected off that and then have to relocate most likely to the area. They're trying to move quickly to get the position filled. They recognize that it's important to have that position filled. They may bring in a temporary person to serve as a sort of a bridge between the new hire and myself.
So will you work with the new superintendent?
Sure. Obviously, you know, I'm not leaving the National Park Service. I'm still part of it. I have a lot, my personal self invested in Cape Lookout. I want to be sure that the next person that comes in will be, you know, have all the benefits of anything that I've learned while I'm here. You know, we'll definitely exchange notes, so to speak. And obviously, I'll be at their disposal if they need some help once they get settled and have questions about the park. And again, the park staff is great. They'll have a great team to help them carry them forward as well. So I think that the next person will be in a good position.
What will you miss most about Eastern North Carolina and Cape Lookout?
I always marvel every time I go out to Cape Lookout at that we're so fortunate in Eastern North Carolina to have these remote barrier islands. To me, that experience of standing on a beach that's totally undeveloped is quite an experience. And there are very few places like that left, especially on the East Coast. I'm one of those strange people. I like going out there when it's not summer because there's less people, and it's just a real special place. I'll miss the people. The park staff has been great to me, and as well as the community. And I feel like I've been very welcomed here in Eastern North Carolina.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with your new job and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, sir. You too. Happy Thanksgiving.
Politically charged discussions are a common but often unwelcome guest at the dinner table during the holidays. Even relatively innocuous stories or lighthearted jokes about the subject seem to ignite heated arguments. At times, those strong disagreements play out at public forums, social gatherings, or family get-togethers. Chris Thomas has this.
So, you're around the dinner table or with family and friends for the holiday, and then it happens. The conversation turns to politics.
There has been many a family gathering in my family where the subject was dropped.
Mary Tucker McLaughlin, a communication professor at ECU and former news producer.
Because people just did not agree, could not agree, and, you know, it was problematic.
Throughout 2016, North Carolina has been in the middle of the controversy, from House Bill 2 to redrawing its congressional district lines to its role as a crucial swing state.
I've never seen our country so terribly polarized. We're just at opposite ends of the spectrum, and people aren't listening to the other. We're just into our own selves and just not listening to the other.
That's Claudia Sundinen, a Greenville resident.
We are not only not talking to one another, but we're not understanding one another.
It harkens back to a long-held belief that a person cannot talk about politics and religion in polite company. Brad Lockerbie, a political science professor at ECU, believes it speaks to an underlying matter, morality.
People feel a little bit more strongly about those than other issues that are more negotiable, that you can compromise more easily on economic policy, spending, taxes, and such. You can split the difference, but it's hard to split the difference on abortion or prayer or gay rights.
Lockerbie, a professed political junkie, enjoys talking policy in theory, but when things become overly acrimonious, that's when it's time to walk away.
If the conversation can't be restored to a level of amity or calmness, I don't feel like I have an obligation to take part in it.
There are times, though, when that's not always an option, unless you want to further strain a key professional or personal relationship. Sometimes you just have to grin and bear it, unless something else comes up.
It's always good to just redirect the conversation if it's not going in, you know, in a pleasant direction, and if people are going to be upset.
Well, that shouldn't be too hard. Diversity is a defining trait of the national culture, and Dr. Lockerbie believes there's usually another topic to grab everyone's attention.
Most of us don't let politics animate our lives entirely. We have other interests, whether it be sports or just simply tending to our family, that takes precedence over politics.
So, how does one leave point A and move to point B? Sometimes that may require clever thinking, finding a word or phrase related, even loosely, to another, more pleasant topic, and bringing that up instead. If that window is too narrow, then perhaps a more direct and proactive approach is needed. Before things can get too heated, it may be worth reminding everyone where their priorities should lay, Dr. Tucker McLaughlin says.
You know, you can also talk to family members about the importance of just listening to each other, not interrupting, not pointing fingers, not making arguments and discourse personal, but making them about facts and about what's out there. And you know, sometimes that helps. And other times you just have to set it aside and say, this is just not something that we can discuss right now.
If that doesn't work, then one may have to retreat into one's mind for relief. Amy Bright, an ECU student and activist, tries to remember that we're all people here.
I always try to remember that everybody is a human being and everybody has the same general human characteristics regardless of which side of the aisle we reside on. And what that means is that we're all complex. We're not good and bad. We're all somewhere in the middle of that.
And for those that may be itching to bring up those polarizing subjects around the Thanksgiving turkey or the water cooler, perhaps you could take a word of advice from Glenn Hubbard, one of Dr. Tucker McLaughlin's colleagues at the ECU School of Communication.
Is this hot topic that everybody's so up in arms about, is it really that important for me to say my piece about?
Election Day has come and gone, but the discussion on its impact is just beginning. If you feel like digging into the weeds, you'll probably have plenty of company, even after the relatives leave. Just remember, there's a time and place for everything. I'm Chris Thomas.
With the holiday season underway, you know that many meals will be shared. When people eat, they talk, and given enough talk, they'll tell you about what they eat. That's the concept behind Amy Rogers' collection of stories and recipes entitled Hungry for Home, Stories of Food from Across the Carolinas. George Olson spoke with the Charlotte resident and has this, which originally aired in May of 2004.
It's pretty easy to thumb through Hungry for Home and say cookbook, period, and you wouldn't be wrong. There are over 200 recipes in the book from over 100 contributors, including some from noted authors like Jill McCorkle and Jerry Bledsoe, but primarily from non-professional chefs that Amy Rogers calls home cooks. Whether from writers or non-writers, virtually all the recipes come with a story, some which only vaguely have some tie to the recipe itself, but all with some type of emotional tie to the end product. That can seem somewhat surprising when you're talking about a biscuit recipe, but Rogers thoroughly expected that type of conviction.
Just because we live in a region where there hasn't always been an abundance of food throughout the ages past doesn't mean that there's been a scarcity of tradition and culture. I think the fact that Carolinas are so rich with an oral tradition of storytelling really is shown through these recipes, because a recipe is something that can be just orally passed down, it can be written down, it becomes incorporated in who we are. I encountered so many people who had recipes that they prepared for generations past, and those were the stories that I enjoyed the most.
Some of the stories don't even really involve food, such as this tale Amy Rogers wrote about peach farmer and author Dory Sanders, highlighting the ability of rural Southerners to take next to nothing and stretch it into something.
The peaches did not survive the early cold spring of 1997. What would Sanders do when the customers began arriving in June, looking for those wonderful peaches to put in pies, cobblers, and homemade ice cream? That was the summer Dory Sanders sold rocks. Not just any old rocks, but 100% genuine farm rocks, each with its own certificate of authenticity. She sold them to kids, and she sold them to grown-ups. She carefully washed the peach-sized hunks of rosy quartz, polished them up to look pretty, set them out on the farm stand tables, and when people stopped by to ask what she was doing, she told them, "We don't have any peaches today, but we do have farm rocks that you can take home with you."
For Rogers, Dory Sanders is perhaps the epitome of the home cooks who contributed recipes and their related stories, talented, resourceful, and equal parts ready to share or talk about food.
Well, I think it's interesting because the Carolinas are such a place of great storytellers that it only makes sense that we would also be great storytellers when it comes to food. Dory Sanders, the wonderful author and peach farmer, is fond of saying, "If it weren't for food and who died, we wouldn't have anything to talk about."
Having to talk about food is one of the reasons the job description for cookbook author has to be among life's more pleasant, though it probably doesn't outweigh the fact a cookbook author has to be a willing sampler of much food. That was the case for Rogers in putting together Hungry for Home. She says of the 200-plus recipes in the book, she attempted to make or at least sampled almost all of them. Rogers says as a journalist, she often uses food to explore a region's culture. It was recipes she decided not to taste test that said the most about the South, where we are contrasted to where we've been.
Some of the traditions, which are at least a generation or two removed from our daily lives, are the ones that still kind of make me think twice about who we are and how far we've come. We do have recipes for snapping turtle, and we do have recipes for possum. And I confess to not having tried those, although Doris Davis, who submitted them to us, has done them. And she recognizes that that was not that long ago, the way some people ate routinely. So that's a tradition that's very important to recognize here. I don't attempt to supersede her ability to cook a possum, I will tell you that.
Even if she had the will to supersede someone else's ability to cook a possum, she might not have the touch. If there's one thing Rogers has learned in talking with and observing the home cooks who contributed to Hungry for Home, it's that intangibles are everything.
I think there's something in every recipe that's a bit intuitive, even if it's spelled out as clearly as you can imagine. I think every cook has his or her own touch, but the best cooks are not typically the ones who do measure.
That is the case with Virginia Jackson, whose buttermilk biscuit recipe appears midway through the book. The recipe involves a grand total of 3 ingredients, which leads one to think, how hard can it be? Hard? No. Able to successfully replicate? Perhaps not. In an essay accompanying Jackson's recipe, Rogers speculates why.
Virginia can't remember all the contests she's won, but she never forgets the key to making perfect biscuits. She advises this: keep your mind on what you're doing, don't just throw them together, and forget using a mixer or even a spoon. Virginia mixes every batch with her hands. It seems so simple, 3 ingredients. So there must be a secret, something that makes one biscuit or cake or pie or bread different and special. If that something doesn't come from the store or out of a book, where does it come from? Can it be measured like so much flour and shortening? In Virginia Jackson's strong brown hands lies at least part of the secret. When your hands have worked the fields, tamed a garden, and cared for children, almost anything is possible. Virginia's touch is unique. A talent like hers can be learned, but it comes only by doing, with care and with practice. And learning takes time, an investment too few are willing to make. But there's something else still, something that comes from the heart. I went to Virginia Jackson's house back in 1994, I think it was, because I had found out through my own research that she was the Blue Ribbon biscuit baker for all of North Carolina. She had won the Blue Ribbon at the state fair. So I called up Miss Jackson, and she very kindly allowed me to come to her house and watch her make biscuits. And I felt like I was in the presence of true magic. I watched what she was doing. She wrote down the recipe. I took the recipe home with me. And then I sat down to do those biscuits. And they were pretty good, but they were not as good as hers. Not because I did anything wrong, but because, as I say in the story, your hands learn almost kind of without your mind telling them when something is right. And that only comes with time and practice.
Amy Rogers is the author of Hungry for Home, Stories of Food from Across the Carolinas, which is published by John F. Blair. I'm George Olson.
This is Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of The Garden Journal. After last year's record warm and wet winter, it's time to turn our thoughts towards this year's winter weather forecast. So far, our fall temperatures have been relatively warm, and after the effects of Hurricane Matthew, relatively dry. But what does our winter have in store? Well, the answer is likely more of the same. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration recently released their winter outlook forecast for 2016-2017. NOAA looks at many things when determining their weather forecast, including ocean temperature patterns. Last year, we had an El Niño pattern. The tropical Pacific Ocean waters were warmer than normal. These warm waters encourage the development of storms, so El Niño weather patterns tend to generate more rain and result in wetter weather for us in the southeast. This year, we have the reverse pattern, La Niña. In La Niña years, the tropical Pacific Ocean waters are cooler than normal. These cooler waters suppress the development of storms and rainfall, and in the eastern Carolinas, typically result in dry, mild days interrupted by occasional cold Arctic outbreaks. The La Niña expected to develop for this winter should be a weak one. We can expect our winter to be slightly milder and drier than average, but not dramatically so. So what does this mean for our lawns and gardens? For established lawns, trees, and shrubs, the slightly drier weather may actually be a good thing. Last winter's wet weather and the effect of our summer storms, including Hurricane Matthew, have left us with adequate groundwater levels. Waterlogged soils can cause their own problems by promoting fungal diseases like large patch and root rots, or by simply suffocating plant roots. The drawback to the slightly drier weather is that plants that have been damaged by waterlogged soils often start to decline as the soil starts to dry out and the plant is not able to move adequate water through its compromised root system. When it can't move enough water and keep up with demand, we start to see symptoms. So if you have established plants that start to struggle, it may be worth investigating whether there's an underlying problem with the root system. For newly planted lawns, trees, and shrubs, you'll need to be on the lookout and apply irrigation if needed. Fall is the best time for us to plant trees and shrubs, and these plants often need little water as we tend to get plenty of rain during the fall and winter months. That said, especially this year, you want to make sure that the soil does not dry out around new plantings. So provide them with irrigation if we have had several weeks without rain. The warmer weather can provide its own challenges. Plants need the weather to cool down and stay cool in order to achieve dormancy, or that phase of plant rest that is most resistant to cold weather. If temperatures fluctuate rapidly from warm to very cold, plants can experience cold damage. We saw a fair amount of that last winter when the temperatures around Christmas time hovered in the 80s, and then in January dropped dramatically down below freezing. Even though it was not a particularly hard freeze, many plants were damaged because they were still not fully dormant. In fact, I lost a well-established crepe myrtle when the cambium, that living layer underneath the bark, froze during that cold snap. There's not much that we can do to control the temperature, but keep an eye on plants and be prepared to cover particularly special plants with tender growth if temperatures are expected to drop dramatically over a short period of time. So that's the official weather forecast for winter 2016-2017. Now, it will be interesting to see how well the forecast measures up with reality.
I'm Byron Mumaw, and here's what to look for in the Carolina skies. If you are interested in amateur astronomy but are not sure how to begin, here's the first thing that you should know. It is not necessary to have a telescope or even a pair of binoculars. All you need is to look up with your two eyes and take in the beauty of the starry night sky. Don't worry if you cannot recognize all those obscure constellations with the odd names that you have seen on the star chart. Just go out on a clear night to a reasonably dark location and find a nice spot to lie down, relax, and look up at the sky. Give your eyes 15 minutes to adjust to the dark and notice how many stars you can see there. You'll begin to notice shapes and patterns among the stars. Human brains are hardwired to notice patterns. There's a name for these patterns. They are called asterisms. These asterisms may in some cases be actual constellations, but more often they are either part of a large constellation or a part of several adjacent constellations. It is useful to find a few of these star patterns that you can easily spot whenever you look at the sky. These then act like signposts in the sky that will help you locate specific constellations and objects of interest. Here's an easy example to start with. In November, it is best to find this between 6:30 and 8 p.m. Face west and look almost straight up. You will see a bright star. This is Deneb. If you then look a short distance to the west of Deneb, you'll see an even brighter star. This is Vega. Vega is the brightest star you can see in the sky until much later in the night when Sirius arises in the east. Now look a short distance south of Deneb and Vega. There you will see another star that is brighter than Deneb and not quite as bright as Vega. This star is Altair. Now imagine lines connecting these three stars. This forms a very easy-to-spot triangle pattern that is high overhead from July through November. Since it comes into view each summer, it is referred to as the Summer Triangle. The Summer Triangle spans across five constellations, so you can use this asterism as your signpost to locate and identify the following: Cygnus, the Swan, Lyra, Vipecula, the tiny constellation Sagitta, and finally, Aquila, the Eagle.
So what I have been describing to you is the method observers use to find an easy-to-spot star pattern and then use this pattern to locate more difficult-to-spot star groupings in and around it. Next time, I'll describe another easy-to-spot pattern, the Great Square. Until then, I wish you clear skies.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.